This is Scott Woods. It's December 7th, 2009. Once again, chatting with Bob Dobbs. This is our fifth conversation. We're delving into rock critics and rock criticism. How you doing, Bob?
Great. I'm looking forward to looking at this Bangs article.
Excellent. Yeah, we're taking a little sidetrack, I guess, or a detour into a slightly different direction for this one. We'll maybe only go for like 40, 45 minutes or so. So the article, Bob, that I sent you was it's collected in Bangs' collection, Psychotic Reactions and Carburetor Dung. It's a piece he wrote, I believe, 1978 for a magazine called Gig, and it's about Richard Hell. It's called Richard Hell, Death Means Never Having to Say You're Incomplete. Now, I'm not really sure why I chose this one to send you. I think I sent you three or four Bangs pieces from this book. And you said you had read some of this stuff, obviously, back then.
Yeah.
I guess it's a piece, you know, I find kind of really moving. And it's Bang sort of grappling with, you know, I think what he sort of thought were kind of the, you know, some of the central sort of questions of his time or his life or something.
Yeah.
It really is kind of about punk nihilism. And, you know, this whole idea that death is kind of, you know, a part of the act itself or something. So why don't I just throw a couple of quotes at you and we'll just sort of take it from there. So,
yeah.
So pretty much near the top of the article, page 261, second page actually, second paragraph down, this is what Bangs writes. Trying to tell you why I believe in at least part of what Richard Hell is saying might be like scraping the silence out of my heart. It will prove easier, I'm afraid, to explain why I must ultimately reject his program. I'm passionate about his music, even as I suspect that his music and all we feel for it is a displaced passion. I wanted to write a book about why nobody wants to have emotions anymore, and because he's one of the few thinkers I respect, I showed some of my writing to Richard a year or so ago. And then Richard says, he said he read this Cassandriad several times with a quiet, unblinking intensity, then said, "The thing is that people don't have to try to not feel anything anymore. They just can't." So that's kind of what I'm interested in. We talked a little bit about the idea of emotion in our first chat. What do you think?
Yeah, the quote is, "The thing," it's a Cassandra. You know, Cassandra was someone saying the world is dying kind of thing.
Right, right.
So this Cassandriad, and like a dunciad, an IAD, Cassandriad, or Cassandriad. So Bangs is saying his personal complaint and bemoaning about his psychological state or the world, or both. He read this Cassandriad several times with a quiet, unblinking intensity, then said, quote, "The thing is that people don't have to try not to feel anything anymore. They just can't," meaning they can't feel.
Right.
So, well, immediately, and I, you know, at risk of citing McLuhan again, what did he say? McLuhan said that media numb us. People get numbed by speech, and then they got numbed by writing, and then the printing press, and then movies, and then radio, and then television. Whatever it extends, whatever the medium extends, it numbs them. So it's really, and that is what McLuhan calls narcosis. So what do you call it? Narcissist as narcosis. This whole numbing thing is really interesting, and right off the bat, jumping off the McLuhan point, is that people were becoming, by the 70s, aware of the numbing process, because there were so many technological environmental changes, and McLuhan said that the service of that is that nobody's going to get stuck in any particular bias, because I got to adapt to another kind of medium, and it's sensory bias, immediately. Like, they get in the car and they deal with that medium. Then they listen to the radio and they deal with that medium. Then they watch TV. Then they read a book. Each one creating a different effect. Generally, we talk on the collective level, but people think it's personally affecting them. So on the private level, they do these different environments in the daily run of the North American experience anyways in the 60s and 70s. And he said, because we could not get stuck in any one medium and therefore be molded for it by it, and it becomes a habit, and then we don't know we're numbed by it, and it becomes a cliche, because we can't get sort of stuck in one form, this is liberating. It's the first time humanity has ever been able to be detached from the seductive role a medium has. And in a slower-paced society, whatever culture you're in, you would be numbed into the culture's bias. Okay, so if we are being awakened, and McLuhan would point out that people don't know why they feel this weird not being able to get involved in my culture anymore or can't get involved in the new culture, but I'm in a limbo. He was trying to explain and help people realize where their wakeful numbness was coming from.
Their what? Wakeful?
Wakeful numbness.
Right.
They were becoming aware that they were numbed. A person, you go to any slower time, a slower culture, they don't know that they're numbed by the cultural cliches and technologies they use. But we were becoming aware by the second half of the 20th century that we were numbed by something. We were becoming aware of the numbing process.
In other words, speed?
Yeah, speed of metamorphosis. You keep engaging different forms. You read a book. Then you get in your car and you whiz down the highway and you put on the car radio. You go, wow, this is a different experience from reading a book, right? Then you get out of the car and go and watch a movie and you say, oh, this is a neat, if you only would half know this. Because you want to have a different experience. I'm sick of being in the car. Okay, let's go to the mall and go to the Cineplex and go to a movie. Okay, well, this is fun. Okay, we've done the movie now. Where do we go? Well, let's go to a disco. And then you have that experience. Look at the different technological environments one goes through. We become addicted to shifting from one environment to another. But in the course of that, we will notice, I had a different bunch of feelings when I was reading my book at home, and I have a different bunch of feelings here in the disco or the punk store or where do they go today? I don't know, Starbucks or something. And because we have so many different environments, we become aware that they have affected us because we now move into another environment. Oh, yeah, this is not like reading a book. People who just read books for entertainment, 200 years ago, they didn't know anything different other than speech or opera or something, or music, right?
Right, right.
But you move, the sensitive individuals would notice, it's different, different sensory experience in the opera than when I'm reading a newspaper. But they didn't have so many changes. Okay, so what I see here is that actually people are, quote, feeling more, but that may not be the right word, and we're becoming aware that we actually are numb as we engage each environment. We become, well, that was different. I was not thinking of a disco experience when I was reading a book. You get what I'm saying? You become aware of the gradations and metamorphoses you're going through in a speeded up trend, a culture where you're going from one form to another in the course of your 24 hours. So you would become aware that there's a numbing going on. So Richard is pointing out, when he says, they don't have to try not to feel, they can't anymore, is just beginning to look at the issue. And if he writes, if he interprets that you're not feeling at that point, he hasn't begun. He's actually becoming aware. We feel more. We become aware that, oh, there's degrees of numbness that we feel. There's degrees of areas where I might think I'm not feeling. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
It's like McLuhan said, a kid watches TV then walks into the classroom. The classroom is rigid and linear and visual and nowhere near like the tactile experience of television. They're going to be jolted by that. Just now, this is weird. This is actually uncomfortable. I've got to sit here and look at one flat page, whereas if I was home, I could be scanning my screen and channel hopping. This is a prison, this school. So you feel, and then you say, I can't get into this. So then you become mentally a dropout in the school, and you might think you're numb. But then you forget your numbness when you get out of the school and get in your car and whiz down the highway.
Right.
Right? So, go ahead.
Okay, well, so, I mean, I guess what kind of interests me about this passage, too, and about this whole piece, though, is it's Bangs is trying to deal with it. He says right in there, I must ultimately reject his program. And it's kind of a very common theme from him, especially like in his last few years of being alive and writing. Like it's alienation, sort of like the whole like alienation as a subject itself worth exploring comes into a lot of his writing, and his kind of, I hate to use the word stance, but his stance on the whole sort of situation is, he's fighting against the encroaching sort of alienation that everyone feels, and he's I mean, he writes this stuff in such a kind of, like, it is like sort of an outburst of emotion himself. So, what do you make of that? Like,
yeah,
the way they're kind of rubbing off against, rubbing up against each other or whatever on that? Or
it's like, Bangs is this sensitive kid. And let's say he walks out of high school in 67, 68 or whatever, and he walks down the street and he's puzzled about all the feelings he's feeling. He has no way to be objective about it. He's just experiencing it, all this. And he bumps into a hobo. And the hobo starts saying some stuff, and Bangs, it immediately communicates to him, immediately has meaning to him. So he says, "Who are you?" He says, "Well, I'm a hobo, you know, I just travel around, hitchhiking that." "Well, you know any other hobos if you're leaving town?" "Oh, yeah, Bill will be coming through next week. You can talk to him." Look at this thing. He projects, he's so open to being massaged about his issues as he's walking down the street, that the first guy who kind of will address his issues in an intriguing way, he wants more of it. Well, that's what happened when he encountered Rock. And this happens to every kid on a vast scale. They, "Oh, my God, this stuff communicates to me. My teachers don't communicate to me. I don't care about a flat book. It's boring. It's a textbook. I get tests on it." It's almost like Bangs bumped into pop music, rock music, and then, you know, Fringe music and Cream magazine music, and then he's in New York. Let's say he wasn't feeling that way when he was 18, but by the time in the late 70s, and you go to New York, it's a crisis for anybody who lives in New York, because it's such a vast place, you know, and it's hard to find out what you are, and you might be a while to find a community. It's like Dave Wally said to me, the guy who wrote the first book on Zappa, said, "Don't come to New York unless you have a gig, you're making money, and, you know, and you got something already, like you just paratrooped in. If you come and start trying to find a place, and you basically, if you don't have an education, you're screwed. You'll end up, you know, in really exploitative situations." So here's Bangs. He's got a role when he comes. He's a Cream magazine guy. You know, he has a role.
He was a bit of a legend by the time he went there.
Yeah. But even that, because it's so transitory, the rock world, and being a writer, he's looking for a larger role for himself, and therefore he's constantly alienated, like anybody else that goes to New York who's on the margins, like Bangs. And then he's looking for the hobo that will assuage his situation, soothe him, and it's a bunch of bands at CBGBs. It's interesting that he got stuck in that world, looked for meaning in a kid who was going through his own trauma, you know, Richard Hell. And if you get lost listening to music and all that, what, you lose your ability to read and to find the good stuff to read, because that would mean withdrawing from all that noise for a couple of years and not writing about it and actually doing some introspection that only good books can give you. Now, he was probably reading, but it was always within the noise of New York society. Just like on a larger level, no kid can get any sense of himself in school and in college, because everything is all noisy and there's so much shit going on, okay? So here he is focusing on a hobo named Richard Hell, who is equally limited because they're young. See, that's why McLuhan said these kids are vegetables. They don't know what they're up against. There's no way they can know. They don't know they're going to be put through these environmental transformations constantly, and it's even going to happen faster and faster. I mean, you now have, and I like to cite this, kids in Japan. I mean, this is a rumor. I haven't met any of these kids, but they say there are a lot of kids in Japan over the last few years who refuse to leave their bedroom, you know? They're like 18, 19, 20. They won't do anything, and they sit in there and play on their computer for 2 years or something.
Right.
And they're suicidal. Those kind of, when I hear a story like that, that's totally understandable to me. I don't think the kid's wrong. I don't think the parents are wrong. They're up against a whole environment that nobody is preparing them for. And it's very hard to prepare them for. So here is this private concern about his own effort to be an artist and a writer, mixing up with people who are junkies. I mean, it's ridiculous. But then, I don't judge him for being a junkie, because we know why they're a junkie. McLuhan say, you pretty well need to be a junkie to survive today, if you want to function at the speed of light that society's moving along. That's why when he reviewed Burroughs's book, he was saying that. You know what I mean? This is he's the most appropriate guy to describe our world, because he's a junkie. Now, you know, you're a Christian moralist in Middle America. That's nuts. You know what I mean?
But is that why Richard Meltzer, is that why he interpreted McLuhan as saying?
Yeah, he's pro-junk.
Pro-junk.
Yeah, and that's, he certainly McLuhan was not pro-junk. He was saying, I can understand why a writer today, a top avant-garde writer, would come out of the junk experience, because we live in a technological addictive junking experience. The whole planet's been junked. Nature's been junked. So if you want to be perceptive about it, you take heroin just to get an escape or to get a different view. You can't get a different view from an album or a book or a movie. You got to have a psychedelic, psychotropic experience just to begin to perceive what's happening. So McLuhan then says, that's why Burroughs is relevant, but let's point out, now we posted this on the site, did you know that McLuhan writes a letter saying privately to Wilfred Watson, his colleague, in November 64, when he's telling Wilfred Watson how he's writing the review for Burroughs, and he says, Burroughs is not a very bright person.
Yeah, I think I've seen that, yeah.
Yeah, he's reacting, not acting. Well, what's it mean to act, you know? But that's another level. We can get into that later. The point is, he's not impressed with Burroughs himself. He's impressed with the fact that people think a junkie story or a junkie sensibility will be meaningful to people, at least those that are interested in knowing things or being perceptive about the present. But McLuhan, his whole agenda is to say, hey, you don't have to become a junkie if you understand me. I understand why you're going to be junkie, and McLuhan wrestled with whether he was going to do LSD himself. All right?
He was going to what, sorry?
Do LSD himself.
Okay.
And Barry Nevitt told him not to do LSD because he had that brain surgery. This would be in 68.
Right.
And then McLuhan, he tells this story in the Playboy interview, I think. He flies to Vancouver, and when he lands to do a keynote speech at some university there, he's arrested by customs. And they take him aside and they said, okay, where's the LSD? And he says, what do you mean? He says, well, someone on the plane overheard you saying that you were going to Vancouver to pick up your LSD. And McLuhan said, no, I'm picking up an LLD, Doctor of Laws or whatever it is. And the guy, okay, sorry. But that was a humorous thing, but he was the guy thought he was picking up his LSD. But that was in response to a question by Playboy, did you ever take LSD? And then he tells how this interview was done before. No, it was done after his surgery. So he says that, no, I haven't, but here's the joke. I got busted for it, you know what I mean, picking up my LSD. He did say in the 68-69 period that thinning his wake was better way to do LSD than to do LSD itself. Because by the 68-69, after writing a positive interview about psychedelics or an encouraging article in 65, reviewing William Masters' The Varieties of Psychedelic Experience, I think that was his name, co-written with Gene Houston, but by 69, he's blasting LSD as chemical warfare, because by then you're starting to see the kids strung out in Haight-Ashbury and all over the place in the counterculture. You know what I mean? It's not.
Okay, yeah.
It's a whole different world in 69 than 65. But every year is 200 years, so the technological transfers happen that fast. And so it's like 1,000 years later in 69 compared to 65. But McLuhan knew why that was. So, now, I know there's an interview with Eric McLuhan, who always was good at repeating his father's stuff in a comprehensive, understanding way. There was an interview done with him in 77, 78, right at the time of this article, where he's saying, I can understand why the punks are sticking needles. That was the image that was around since the summer of 77, right?
Exactly,
I understand why people are sticking needles and rings in their noses and all that first, and tattooing them. What?
Safety pins, yeah.
Yeah, he says, because they feel numbness, they can't feel their physical chemical body because they're living in the electrified, what he called discarnate state, the electrified body, the electrified mental landscape. Therefore, you're feeling and responding to the tactile electric environment, and it's hard to feel your limited chemical body. And so you stick needles in it to sort of wake it up. So the very issue that a major punk writer like Richard Hell is saying, we know we can't feel, he doesn't say that's why we stick needles in ourselves, but that's actually that was the British response. The punkers didn't do that. They stuck heroin in themselves, but the British kids stuck, safety pins and wore garbage bags as clothes. They're trying to, as McLuhan said a few years earlier, the hippies were trying to feel the ground. They were trying to get back on the physical ground, and that's why they went barefoot. He was always looking at the collective effect from the point of view that we had, from a physical level, disappeared, gone into a new level of feeling. So that's why, you know, people can't feel. But if McLuhan walked into that apartment where Helen and Bangs are talking, he would explain to them why they're feeling that way. So I'm trying to do this 30 years later. This is what I would have said to them if I was at that conversation.
But possibly a weird question, though. Why? I mean, maybe the answer is just, well, they're the artists of the time. But why would just? I mean, it's still at the time it was certainly seen as an extreme thing to do, and it's not like why would it just be a certain substrata of society that would like play it out that way?
Okay, before I answer that, another part about we can't feel anymore. McLuhan used to point out that you can't feel unless you have the language. You can't know anything unless you have words. All right? The words help you know things and determine your relationships to the object or the situation.
Yeah.
So in a post-verbal, Finneganese kind of environment that the global hologram was creating in the 60s and into the 70s, certainly language, and McLuhan wrote about this in the late 60s, that language was fading out, speech was fading out. People were communicating in other multi-leveled ways, multi-technical ways, like speeding down the highway is a form of communication. So speech and language was really becoming anemic and puny for describing what you were feeling. And so you have these young kids, what they're really saying is, I don't know how to express in words what I'm experiencing in this confusing, chaotic, speeded-up society. They don't have the language. They don't have... Now, here's the whole thing. Here is he's calling Richard Hell a poet, but, you know, wrote a few lines, but his real poetry is being up on stage making noise, right?
Well, and Richard Hell says, and I don't know if it's in this article, I think it might be where he says, the blank generation, that, like, it's literally a blank. You fill it in how you want.
Yeah, because they were trying... They didn't know, they are looking for ways for their mouth and their eyes to express stuff. And they didn't know that you're expressing yourself by getting in a car, or turning on the radio, or writing a letter to the editor. I mean, there's interacting with other media that are not limited to the verbal. That is what always the counterculture is expressing in a frustrated, innocent way. And so you have to figure out how to look at how you're communicating, regardless of your opinions or your statements or your paintings, your puny chemical body arts. And so that's what punk is, totally understandable. It is, you have a noisier environment by a technological mix in the late 70s compared to the 60s. So the Beatles, you had psychedelic noise in the 60s, and then you had punk noise, hyper noise, in the late 70s, and that was an appropriate way to describe what you actually are feeling. See,
is it totally understandable, though?
Yeah. I'm trying to show you how I understand it, and I think it is a practical way to understand it. I mean, I liked punk as soon as I experienced it. I bounced around immediately because I felt the environment, probably was a little more aware of it because I was training myself into seeing what was going on, and it released my feelings.
But the totally understandable part makes me pause a little bit. I mean, the McLuhan sort of the McLuhan angle, the McLuhan analysis of it makes a lot of sense. But you know, I think we've come up against this kind of thing before. But why is it? Why is that the totality of the understanding? Like, I mean, I guess I'm, you know, trying to maybe sort of inject some of the human scale back in here or something. I don't know.
Okay.
I get little worried by the phrase totally understandable.
In understanding the collective psychic secular world, does a personal, you know, on personal understanding about how achieved you feel, your self-esteem, how much happiness, how much religious ecstasy, I don't know, whatever people personally are trying to find in existence, you know, the existential questions, That is probably never answered, though people come up with different answers in different ways.
But
rock music is a corporate thing. I remember someone telling me, they said, you know, you'll never get self-understanding watching TV. You have to go withdraw and isolate yourself if you want self-understanding. Now, that was the traditional way. That's like the monk way, withdraw.
Hey, Bob. Bob, dumb down one thing you're saying a little bit, because honestly, I think I get what you mean when you say rock is a corporate.
Yeah.
Talk about the definition of corporate, what you actually mean by corporate.
Corporate is everybody's experiencing it. I don't mean General Motors.
Exactly. Okay, that's it. But I want you to clarify that. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
But go into that a bit. What do you mean what everyone's experiencing?
Everybody in the 50s was in North America, in the West, was experiencing television, as well as automobiles and highways and newspapers and nightclubs and radio, all the media panoply. That's what we live. You know, driving a car is experience, and it's corporate. It's not a private thing. Everybody's driving a car.
Right, so corporate is not private.
Yes. Now, it doesn't create a private identity. What creates a private identity is the book. Now, when everybody is reading books by the 19th century, large numbers of the population, some people say, oh, no, only one-third were literate. But anyways, a good number of people are reading books before movies and cars and all that. That is a corporate shared experience. Everybody's corporate, but it creates a sense of a private identity because you do it by yourself. All right? So that's okay. McLuhan's main point, is that the effect of the book is it makes you think... It makes you experience society slightly by yourself because you engage with the book and read it to yourself silently, and that is a big part of what you bring from it when you interact with others.
Okay.
Once you have radio, everybody's listening to radio, that's not a private-inducing sensibility effect. You actually start thinking of group mind because everybody is sort of doing it at the same time live. And he called that a corporate experience, a corporate effect, as opposed to a private effect.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so electric media has a corporate effect, meaning everybody is sharing the same time, the same information, the same space, as opposed to a private effect by an earlier corporate meaning everybody sharing it, books. So maybe we should say there's the private effect and then there's the corporate effect. Rock, rock comes in the 50s to address the corporate effect that everybody's getting listening to radio and TV. It communicates to teenagers the biological things they're going through, right? Their girlfriends and boyfriends and whatever else they sing about. It was marketed for teenagers and it released them. What is odd? That's why it's odd that someone who graduated out of teenhood and goes to college, like Meltzer, and then starts writing about his teen thing that was important to him. But see, then that is not futile. McLuhan was saying that the whole world was getting corporatized with this corporate effect of everybody in the same space, that the chemical body's markers of who's old and who's young were disappearing. And that would be why you would write about rock, because it went beyond the service for teenagers. As a matter of fact, as the teenagers grew up and became, you know, 20s and 30s in the 60s,
yeah,
they're still engaging in music, electrified music, to release them. The music changed. They get into more interesting word concepts, Dylan and then psychedelic and Zappa or whatever, Lou Reed. They cannot get rid of the need for the radio release. So the mistaken part of the CIA was that, oh, rock music is just a fad for kids. No, it's going to be forever there because these kids are conditioned by that corporate effect, and they're going to need music as they go into the 60s, 70s, and 80s. You see, that's a technological, it's the weather. This storm will continue, and as the storm accelerates, you're going to need some music, electrified fast music. So it went psychedelic, it went disco, it went R&B, or, you know, early soul of the late 60s, early 70s, then disco, then punk, then techno, then rap. It's totally logical that people need their ears to be propped up.
Regardless
of their age.
Okay.
So that's why Bangs could write about kid music, you know, when he's almost 30 and write for magazines, because the kids never grew up on that level. I'm not putting that down. They never could get beyond the need to have ear massage.
Well, and I mean, I still listen to music, you know, made by and for teens myself. But it is so.
No, that's great. No, that's totally understandable, and I do it myself.
But so is pop. So I always come up against the term ephemeral.
Yeah,
because it's used a lot to describe pop music, right? And like, especially with sort of the pre-Beatles stuff, like, you know, doo-wop and girl groups, and you know, some of that stuff that Zappa would kind of replay and stuff,
yeah,
as well. You know, that stuff was always kind of called the novelty and ephemeral. It won't last and stuff. But I mean, is it ephemeral? I mean, it's still people, you know, obviously still listening to it, and now, you know, the technology is obviously enable everyone to sort of, you know, build their own jukeboxes and libraries and all that sort of stuff. I can never get my head around that term ephemeral. I mean, it drives me nuts when I see it used, you know, to sort of as a slagging tool of pop music. But you do say that, you know, it's all sort of transitory and stuff.
Yes.
We'll go into that a little bit.
Yeah, no, it's, you brought us to, as Ian would say, you brought us to a new place, Bob. Well, Scott, you brought us to a new place. The word ephemera and ephemeral is a key meaning, a key fact. It really is what McLuhan's talking about. What is ephemeral? He writes in the 50s that television produces this foam, this surface foam of turnover of information. And it's a lot of foam and a lot of information in the 50s compared to the 19th century. So when we talk about it's a post-information society today, let's go back a phase when people thought it was an information society in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And they're processing all this stuff. And it's like the weather. Is the weather ephemeral? Yeah. What I felt yesterday, I was involved in it, but now it's today. It's a different weather. And I'm engaging in it. And it will be ephemeral and passing and transient what I'm experiencing tomorrow. What
right.
Do you engage?
Like user is the content?
No, it's more of the formal thing. The formal thing is I get in the car, I drive over, I get a burger, then I go to class, then I go to my girlfriend's, then I do something there, and we'll keep that personal and private, won't say what we're doing, maybe we film ourselves and put up on the web today, but anyways, you go to your girlfriend's, and then you go to your job, and then you listen to the radio on the lunch break, and then you go home and watch TV. Look at these technology environments as weather, as environments, hot and cold. You experience all these environments in 20 hours. Then the next day you do it all again. You can hardly remember the experience that you had the day before. But when you were having it, it was important that when you're driving down the highway, a great
right.
song's on, you're into it. Now, tomorrow you'll be on the highway and listening to that song or another song, and then the next day you'll be doing that again, enjoying the song. You can't say that any one of those experiences is an ultimate experience. No, it's all transitory. It's actually abundance. And when you get abundance, everything's ephemeral.
But it's not, I guess I always sort of thought ephemeral meant like, well, I think the way it's used, and maybe it's just used wrongly or badly all the time, is that it will disappear.
Yeah, it has no long-lasting substance.
But if you're still listening to the same pop songs 40 years later or something, it hasn't disappeared.
That's right. It's still foam. Now, literacy, see, this is the thing about literacy, the amazing psychic effect of literacy in books. When you could read a book and go back and read it again and then write a letter to someone, this is 200 years ago, write a letter to someone about what you got from that book, you had time to engage in that little medium. And then you start thinking more introspectively about what you process, because you're listening to a voice talk to you when you read a book. And it's giving you new thoughts besides your own thoughts. And then you add that on. And then you read another book, and you add that on. So you then start sorting these out, and a lot of your psychic activity is sorting out thoughts that you're getting from the books. And then you sit around and discuss them, and then you might write a treatise on them. You had time to write, you know, be like Kant and write a long thing. All right. That is during the literary era, the Gutenberg galaxy. And it would see, as McLuhan said, during the literary phase, the Gutenberg galaxy, our lives were short, and you wore your face is long, because you were actually bogged down by the information overload of stuff you were reading. Whereas you go to pre-literate societies, they have the same rhythms going on every day, but they're in depth in them. But you actually look, okay, they're drumming the same drum every day, but they're enjoying it. And then they do it again the next day. It's the same as someone today listening to radio every day with the same music or change the channel, other music. And, of course, I'm using older media, radio and TV, because we're talking about the 60s and 70s. It's totally different now. But the transitory, the shift of input, sensory input that you have in the 20th century compared to someone 200 years ago just reading books or newspapers or a little book of poetry, so that you actually look back at the 200 years ago, the Gutenberg Galaxy, they were stuck, that society. They were slow. They didn't experience it at the time as that. But consider the variety of experience and abundance we have today, we're not as slow. And it looks like, from a literary point of view and a literary conditioning, that you have no substance. You're not staying with one experience long enough. You don't read the whole book. You know what I mean? You just watch a movie. So the whole idea of substance is a literary effect that came in the Gutenberg Galaxy and did not happen in previous societies.
Right, okay.
In pre-literate societies, they live ephemeral lives, but it's in-depth. We don't live ephemerally. We live in-depth today. And part of depth is you have a repeating environment. In other words, I turn on the radio, and I can have the electrified ear, and there's different content every day, but the main thing is I'm massaging my ear. And I watch a movie that's massaging my eye and my feet. This is an extension of kinetic movement. So look at the many massages you have in the middle of the 20th century compared to the slow society of print. Then you go back to a small little village tribe in New Guinea, and they're living hyped up levels, even though it's very puny. They're just in acoustic space and speech rhythms and little artifacts drumming, but it is a very in-depth and much no stopping at one point, just replaying it a ritual. On a ritual level, in-depth, McLuhan said, that's what we retrieved in the 20th century. We retrieved in-depth experience. But it doesn't have any literary meanings. So it appears to be ephemeral, but if the judgment of ephemerality is only from a literate point of view. And religions come out of heavy literacy, first manuscript and then books. The Protestant religion is built on the book, and that's the major religion was in the 50s, 60s in the United States, Protestants. A Protestant attitude will find the speed up and the abundance of the electric environment to be meaningless because you can't stop and find out what it means. I mean, look at folk. It's really interesting. You had rock, and then the kids, you had Elvis. Then the kids sort of grew out of the Elvis phase, and they're looking for something new, but the industry brought in the Bobby V, Bobby Darin thing for the younger kids, okay? But the kid's becoming 20, and he's starting to go to university or starting reading books, and so he wants meaningful. A temporary phase, wants meaningful music, so they bring in folk music. Okay?
Right, right.
This wailing with meaning, looking for identity. And that is a pet rock fad, because the kids, as they move along, they actually are living a non-literary experience as they process more and more by the mid-60s, and they want someone else, and folk dies. Folk does not have the impact. But you can see it meets a need for baby boomers at that point. But then they get out of college, and they got jobs, and they're living fast, hectic, pressured lives, and they don't have time to hear literary meaning or substance. They're living in depth. They're doing their ritual jobs. Remember I quoted McLuhan saying the twist? The twist was an antidote to the deep corporate collective involvement of their daily work lives, and at night they unwind by twisting off into a private space.
Right.
So you look at all these media fads or participations not as ephemeral and not as superficial, as very involving things that meet the sensory needs for release based on the media mix of the time. So there's a media mix in the mid-50s, which is totally puny compared to the media mix of the mid-60s, which is totally puny compared to the media mix of the mid-70s, and totally puny compared to the media mix of the mid-80s. And the arts and sciences and music and culture changes to respond. That's, in other words, the weather is changing, because the whole 20th century is a storm, a hurricane of electric information overload compared to the 19th or 18th century. You see what I'm saying? You can get that. It's not hard to understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's obvious to me, and yet it's never pointed out, because people like to, especially literate Westerners, they like to have a bird's eye view, a perspective. Well, I'm giving you the bigger view, how to articulate it. This is what I would say to Hell and Bangs at that in their apartment here, you know, when they're talking about. And would they listen? No. I'm sorry. I'm a guy who's using speech, which is an old medium compared. Well, they would turn on the radio, drown me out, you know, strum his guitar, shoot up, you know, because I'd be describing the pressures he's under, and he wouldn't be able to hear my description, which is why it's taken 30 years for me to get the chance to talk about this.
Okay. So why? What do you make of the fact that Bangs is spending this article fighting all this stuff that these kind of glimmers of insight that Richard Hell is giving him about people feeling numb and people not having emotions and stuff?
Because he's proving my point or McLuhan's point that music is a private concern. In other words, he's writing about music. And he's bringing his private concerns into it. He didn't do it as blatantly in most of his articles as he does in here. But it's always...
Sorry, say that again.
He probably didn't do it as blatantly, bring in his personal existential angst as much as he did in this article. In other articles, he probably didn't do as much. But there's always little glimpses of it.
Right.
But this is really going into it. Well, it's a big topic. It's about death, all right? That's a major factor for the chemical body, right?
Yeah.
And yet, there's no awareness. You see, here's what the paradox is. Richard Hell is important in 78 because the punk music is meeting the needs of the sensibility for young people at that point. It's not going to be powerful in 7 years later, but right then. So it's actually where it's at, and Bangs is there. But they're only, it's like Prozac. It's the latest drug for the media mix. We need this kind of sensory massage, like a drug. And Bangs is the manager of the drug industry of that phase, of that period. And yet, because it's an anesthetic, it's not dealing with the larger environment, and you need to read someone or understand someone like McLuhan is talking about a bigger picture that might help you figure out where your death fits in when you're seeing images of death day in and day out on MTV and in all the media, right? So,
right.
You know, overload of discarded imagery, what is your relationship to that? And so how can you, but because nobody can take the time to do this because of the pressures, because Bang's got to keep consuming music, you know, and Christgau is an example. Is it Christgau or Christgau? Christgau, right?
Christgau.
Yeah. Robert Christgau is consuming because he has to keep paying the rent, all right? He's got to roll. Bang's has got that pressure. He's got to keep doing it. You can't get the time to take a break. And so he has to wander around within the industry. He's like at a pharmaceutical, you know, a plant. And he's a manager, and he's having all this existential drama because he doesn't like doing the role he's doing forever. He doesn't think it's leading anywhere. And he talks to the different scientists there who are making different drugs. And he says, you know, I can't feel. And the guy says, well, try this drug. Well, Richard Hell was a bit different. He said, he didn't say try this drug. He just said, yeah, I understand. Yeah, why you can't feel. I feel the same way. It's tough being a scientist here at the drug company. Like, remember what I told Dina Weinstein and these people and Christgau when they were on the panel? You guys are genetic engineers. I'm trying to show that that's a genetic engineering is a reference to the chemical body and how we can, with computers and everything, alter it. Okay, but you're still working on the chemical body, but you're using discarded electrified technology to do it. Well, when you're working in the rock industry, which is an important environment, for kids to have a sense of release in the larger global hologram, then you are altering their chemical body, and you're providing tips on what drugs to consume, called albums or CDs or whatever. That's why you are a genetic engineer, and I mean that's not a great job. That's not an awesome job. It's just what we can do with the electric technology on the chemical bodies. We can start altering our genes. Not so much in 79, but definitely now. And so, a couple of years ago, I said, you guys are genetic engineers. You're just, as McLuhan said, he said, modern symphony conductors, all the Leonard Bernsteins, are mere janitors. They're just ushering through the need for classical music for so-called fake social elite of New York or the cities. You know, when you get certain executive level, you're supposed to go to the opera and celebrate Western Gutenberg culture. So the composer and the conductor is just a janitor. He's just offering the same ritual for you every night. Well, the update of that is being a genetic engineer. A rock critic is just a janitor. He's just surfacing the garbage in, garbage out, and those are not derogatory terms. The ephemera in and the ephemera out, that's what they're describing. They're providing a consumer guide to it. for the person who thinks they need that stuff. And it's not, you can't even, the person who needs it, they don't even think about it, they need it. You know, we posted, you might want to look at this, on somebody posting Five Bodied, this like 15-year-old doing this three-minute thing. It's incredible the mood shift she goes through in communicating herself. And that's what I call quadrophenia, and these kids are proving it. They live way more hyper than what you grew up with.
Right, right.
You know, and I'll send you this thing. It's something to look at. It's really well done by this 15-year-old. But she does. She goes through about 10, 15 modalities of expression.
Okay.
Okay. So that's where they're at today. She goes through. She has 15 kind of drugs she takes, and only takes them for 5 seconds each.
Right, right.
So okay. I'm talking about the weather, and it's a technological weather, and how you react to it, and the role of people need cars. Why do people need cars in Western society? So they can go out, be alone, and think. They can't think at the office. They can't think at home. You get, and you actually want to be in a traffic jam, so you get more time to be by yourself.
Okay. But what about the idea of the self-destruction, like, you know, that Richard Hellenbangs were talking about? I mean, the idea of self-destruction is always being an impulse, you know, in the arts and that sort of thing. I mean, I don't know. You've got it in the jazz. Like, I don't know. It seems like you're connecting it to, you know, the technology of the time or something. But I mean, there's always been that impulse.
Yes. There's always been you know, the futility of life or the ecstasy of life. That's ongoing. McLuhan said the medium is the message, but the human man is always the content. There's the eternal issues. But it's what did he say? He said, the role of the artist never changed. What the artist deals with never changed, but the conditions for expressing the art change.
Okay, so it becomes more extreme as time goes on.
No, it becomes not extreme. It becomes tactile, acoustic, visual. You had writers in the Gutenberg Galaxy. You have acoustic music for the Electric Age. These are the arts that assuage the tensions of the condition of being. Okay, I'm going to show you how great a rock critic I am. I deny anybody has mentioned this, but here's an example.
Okay.
Dylan did an interview, I think, in the late 70s. I know he did it, and I think it might have been the Ron Rosenbaum interview with him. I don't know what magazine it was in. Could it have been Rolling Stone or something. He did an interview, I think, in the late 70s. And he says, when you get up in the morning and cut your fingernails, you die. All right? You don't remember that. Nobody remembers that sentence. They probably didn't take it seriously, but it's a really important sentence. I don't know what Dylan meant by it, but I'm going to take the words on their own face value. How could you die when you clip your, cut your nails with a nail clipper? How could that be? Well, he might have been secretly reading McLuhan. Who knows? But I'm going to put McLuhan in there. Whatever technology you use throughout the day alters your sense ratios, alters your sense of yourself, and you're probably so numb you don't notice it. But you're altered by every object you engage with, your image of yourself. So to actually use a tool and cut your nails, that is altering yourself, and the you that you were up to that point changes, quote, dies.
Right, okay.
And that is a really, that statement, when I read that, I said, that's amazing. Dylan may get it, you know what I mean? Because when nobody took him, Ron or whoever interviewed him should have said, wait a minute, what are you saying? I cut my finger. You should have confronted him, right?
I just found it, Bob. It's the Playboy interview.
And is it Ron Rosenbaum?
It is Rosenbaum. I just looked, Ron Rosenbaum, yeah.
Very good, because
1966.
Now, I know Ron, and he's a great writer. You know, he's done a lot through the years. He had a great column in the New York Observer throughout the 90s, and he's not doing it anymore, but he has a blog or something. But Ron would discuss a lot of these issues we're talking about because he knew a lot of people in New York as a journalist. He wrote for High Times. He did a lot of things, and he would bring up these recurring themes. And every now and then he would meditate on Dylan, especially when a new album would come out. And he would talk about how he prepared for that interview. It's very interesting. He got to hang out with Dylan when I think Dylan was editing Ronaldo and Clara.
Right.
And he spent a lot of private time with Dylan. And I don't know if he tells everything about it, but he has always his little stories about it. And I can't remember them all, but I just know in my mind that he was with Dylan in the late 70s. And he was preparing for an interview. And again, okay, so it's the Playboy interview.
Yeah, 1960.
And have you found that part I'm talking about?
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's hear it. Let's hear it.
Okay, just, I'll go back. Yeah. I'll go back a little bit, actually.
Yeah.
Let's see. How far to go back here would make sense? Because they're really like having a sort of back and forth here.
Yeah.
Actually, it sounds like he's explaining something about Ronaldo. But how could that be 1966?
No. This is 78.
It's weird because it says 1966 at the top, but maybe that's for a different interview. That's weird because it says 66 at the top.
Well, that's the archive, right? That's somebody who's got the wrong date or something.
I think they've got the wrong date, yeah, because they're talking about Ronaldo and Clara, and that's definitely 70s. So, okay. Well, let's see. So Dylan, in one of his answers, the guy says, and failure is no success at all, which, you know, quoting Dylan back to him, Dylan goes, oh, well, we're not looking to succeed. Just by our being and acting alive, we succeed. You fail only when you let death creep in and take over a part of your life that should be alive. Then Playboy guy goes, how does death creep in? Dylan says, death don't come knocking at the door. It's there in the morning when you wake up. How is it there? And Dylan says, did you ever clip your fingernails, cut your hair? Then you experience death.
Now, isn't that incredible? It's so great that we have the Android meme to find us immediately. I mean, isn't that incredible? I quoted it, nobody knows it, and I got proven within 1 minute.
Yeah.
This is really good, because this interview here with Hell is about death, and here's Dylan, this is really, how's that for psychic dowsing? Because they're talking about death. Let's go into what they're saying. Can you go back and reread it, you know, a little slower?
Okay, sure. So, Rosenbaum says, and failure is no success at all.
Let's find out why he says that.
I mean, it's kind of hard because they really are going back and forth here.
They're equally bright guys looking at, it's a good interview probably, you know?
Okay, this is going back quite a bit, but I'll skip a few lines.
Right.
So the guy's saying, let's talk about the message of Ronaldo and Clara. It appears to us to be a personal yet fictional film in which you, Joan Baez, and your former wife Sarah play leading roles, and then blah blah blah, and then Dylan goes, it's about the essence of man being alienated from himself and how, in order to free himself to be reborn, he has to go outside himself.
Okay, let's hold that. Dylan is addressing the existential condition of all humans all the time, right? That's not a media point. He's talking about, quote, the soul, or about how people have to deal with the isolation of consciousness, and who are you connecting with, or can you connect with anybody, right? So he's putting in, I'll call it the, you know, McLuhan statement, the medium is always the message, but man is always the content. So this is a content statement. This is Dylan addressing a spiritual condition or psychological or a soul condition or existential. But they're talking about a movie. Now, note, are they going to talk about the medium of communication while Dylan is focusing on an eternal, non-mediated experience, so to speak, right?
Right.
Okay, so with that proviso, what does Ron say something in response to what Dylan said?
He says, he can return by strength of will to the same body and to Clara.
Oh, wait. Who's saying that?
That's Rosenbaum.
He's quoting something?
No. I'll go back one.
Yeah.
Dylan says, it's about the essence of man being alienated from himself and how, in order to free himself to be reborn, he has to go outside himself. You can almost say that he dies in order to look at time and by strength of will can return to the same body. That's Dylan.
That's just before he becomes a Christian. It's like maybe Ron flipped him into Christianity because Ron failed to assuage the thing in this in-depth conversation. So Dylan got alienated, like banged, and freaked out because a great student of his, Ron Rosenbaum, failed to be meaningful or something. But no, that's an incredible statement by him, right? That's a pretty interesting statement for a Playboy interview. So then what does Ron say?
So he says he can return by strength of will to the same body. And to Clara? It's like he's asking a question, I guess. He can return by strength of will to the same body and to Clara?
Oh, right. He's quoting Dylan. He's quoting Dylan.
He's asking a question, really. It's like he's almost like he's trying to complete Dylan's thought.
Yeah. He's responding to the last sentence that Dylan said.
Yeah, and then Dylan says, Clara represents to Ronaldo everything in the material world he's ever wanted. Ronaldo's needs are few. He doesn't know it, though, at that particular time. And then Ron says, what are his needs? And Dylan says, a good guitar in a dark street. And Ron says, the guitar because he loves music, but why the dark street? And Dylan says, mostly because he needs to hide. From whom? And Dylan says, from the demon within. Pause. But what we all know is that you can't hide in a dark street.
Who says that? Who says that?
This is still Dylan.
Yeah.
But what we all know is that you can't hide on a dark street from the demon within. And there's our movie.
Okay. And then Ron says...
Ronaldo finds that out in the film. And Dylan goes, he tries to escape from the demon within, but he discovers that the demon is, in fact, a mirrored reflection of Ronaldo himself. And Ron goes, okay... Given the personalities involved, how do you define the relationship between you, your personal life, and the film? And Dylan goes, no different from Hitchcock making a movie. I am the overseer. And Ron goes, overseeing various versions of yourself? Dylan says, well, certain truths I know. Not necessarily myself, but a certain accumulation of experience that has become real to me and a knowledge that I acquired on the road. And Ron goes, and what are those truths? Dylan says, one is that if you try to be anyone but yourself, you will fail. If you are not true to your own heart, you will fail. Then again, there's no success like failure. And then he runs.
All right.
Sentence of failure is no success at all. And then that's when he goes into the death part.
Okay, just at that point, you see Dylan, he's ripe for confusion. And, you know, I'm not judging his soul condition there. He's a genius, say, or whatever. But I'm just taking the words. That kind of thinking is the private, literate psyche who thinks he has a self and is trying to reconcile it with death. I mean, whereas, you know, pre-literate cultures don't have a problem with death. They don't think there is death. But a literate culture does. And so he's working out the literate conundrum. And this is probably what, you know, triggers Christopher Ricks in his book on Dylan. You know, that Oxford professor who did...
Right.
All Dylan's stuff is about sin or something. I haven't read it. But anyway, it's what Ben Watson would say is a stupid literary approach to Dylan. But anyways, Dylan is bringing up literary themes here. I mean, I forgot this. This is very interesting. Ron got a lot out of Dylan. I don't recall Dylan talking like that to anybody else, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so he's saying this stuff about his soul and saying he's having truth. Well, are those truths the truth that he's going to say, oh, all right, I'm going to become a Christian just to blow everybody's mind. I'll put it on. I already know it's just another metaphor, but everybody will think I've gone nuts and gone born again. And I'm talking about how people reacted to that, at least from his fan base. What happened to Dylan? It's nuts, you know, going fundamentalist. So, but he might have been doing it consciously because he does move out of it later, 7 years later, so to speak. But maybe he's still a secret Christian and going to Mass or whatever they do. Maybe he's a Baptist, who I don't know. But... let's say that the effect of Ronaldo and Clara, because that was a problem, that film for him. The audience response was a problem. I mean, he had a problem with it.
Yeah.
And so let's say it freaked him out that the movie didn't do, and his truth that he knew at that time from touring did not offer enough ballast or support, and he cracked up because he's going through his divorce rate in 77, that period, too. Then it may have gone beyond what he thought he was confident about in that statement. Now, I would have the gall, or what is it, the gumption, the hubris to come in and say, Mr. Dylan, you're a literate man, and you're overreacting being in the rock and roll industry too long. You're just too much electric tactile acoustic space in your speech. Get out of the studio. Forget about recording. Take a break. Do a media fast. That's why you think you're in this existential dilemma about killing your body. Yeah, I would have brought a McLuhan bunch of stuff into him. Because McLuhan, if you're serious, he can give you some reasons. McLuhan, the second biography of McLuhan's called Escape into Understanding. I'd help him escape into understanding. Now, I'm not saying this as if I could heal him, like I'm a psychiatrist, but I'm telling you what I would say. And it has helped other people, whoever had the luck to encounter me in this healthy way about this issue and had the luck to find meaning in it. I would say that it's a whole media dynamic. There's a huge level of naivety about Dylan and his situation in that way. I'll take that angle. If he really did have a spiritual crisis and needed the Christian thing, And that's not a problem, okay? Everybody needs, McLuhan went to Mass every day, right?
Yeah.
But if he wasn't going through a crisis, it's just him being quadriphenic and cleverly shifting his image just to look different and intrigue people, because he didn't care whether anybody liked what he's doing or not. He just said, well, I'll freak these people out. I mean, he freaked people out with John Wesley Harding right in the middle of the psychedelic San Francisco scene, right? He went country.
Yeah, yeah.
Or a kind of country thing.
Exactly,
so,
yeah, yeah.
So is he, this is a quandary about Dylan. Is he faking all these shifts? You know that movie he did recently where he played Jack somebody and this other guy, Jeff Bridges?
Yeah, well, it's people playing. It's not he's not actually in it, but yeah, it's like a patchwork sort of his life where they have different people kind of playing versions of him almost.
No, that's
that
not
one?
There. I'm talking about the one...
Oh, yeah, that one. I know that one you mean. I like that movie, actually. It's very weird, actually.
Yeah, he's a cowboy guy in jail, and they let him out to do the concert.
Yeah, yeah.
It's almost the character and attitude in that movie is reflecting what he's saying in this interview. Very close. But Jeff Bridges comes up, and Jeff Bridges, one of those guys, says to him, he's a rock critic or something, he says, well, what about Zappa? Bob, what about Zappa? You know what I mean? It's a great encounter there.
He said that in the movie. Oh, okay.
Yeah, he says, what about Zappa? And the cowboy guy, oh, it's not important. I'm just here to do a concert. So that would be, if Dylan is faking all these changes and he's a closet McLuhanite, as he indicates when he says, you want to know about the 60s, read McLuhan in 1985 in that magazine.
Right.
If he's a closet McLuhanite, then this is great acting. He's playing the role that that people project on him, and he did a meta on it by playing that cowboy guy, referring back to this Rosenbaum thing. Okay, this gets complex. I don't know if anybody can follow this, but I'm telling you if he's not faking it, then he is ripe for all the crises that he's coming. Because if you don't understand what the media dynamics are doing to you, whether you're a showbiz star or just you, Scott, or a consumer, you will be nailed by this vortex storm we're in. You will be nailed. And everybody has been nailed since, that's 30 years ago. Look at America. It's destroyed itself in many ways, socially, politically, economically, and other worlds have destroyed themselves because they don't realize what McLuhan said. You better turn that TV off because it's going to wipe you out more than you realize. You know what I mean? So anyways,
we got about 2 minutes, just so you know.
Okay.
Not to cut it off when it's getting good, but you got to inject some realism in here too. No. You finish your point.
Oh no, but I just want you to read what Ron says, and then the fingernails.
Oh, okay. Go back to that part.
Yeah.
Okay. 1 second. I just lost. I just sent you the article, by the way, too. So.
Oh, great.
Okay, so Dylan says the thing, then again, there's no success like failure, and of course Ron says, and failure is no success at all. And then Dylan goes, oh well, we're not looking to succeed. Just by our being and acting alive, we succeed. You fail only when you let death creep in and take over a part of your life that should be alive. And Ron goes, how does death creep in? And Dylan goes, death don't come knocking at the door. It's there in the morning when you wake up. And Ron says, how is it there? And Dylan says, did you ever clip your fingernails, cut your hair? Then you experience death.
Now that, I mean, we got to end, but we can continue with this. This is really important. This is good stuff to analyze what he's saying, as I've already analyzed it. Why would he say that? How are you, you know, that's almost McLuhan. That's like McLuhan's thing. McLuhan would say, you die when you turn on your TV set. He would make it a corporate medium. Dylan is almost making the same point with a private artifact, a little nail clipper. You know what I mean?
So were you saying that you die anytime you come into contact with a media?
Yeah, it changes. If a kid goes to school and learns literacy, whatever, in school, books, learns his numerals and math, and then goes out and turns on the transistor radio, you know, in 1962, your image of yourself that when your classroom is destroyed, and you have a new image shaped by the transistor radio you're listening to. It alters your senses and identity.
That I get, but I mean, something like clipping your fingernails or cutting your hair seems so banal.
Yeah, that is, it's banal, it's silly what he's saying, if you take death meaning real death, where you go to the astral plane or whatever, right? And meet your maker. But what's interesting, he's playing with death as a metaphor, which would be a sub-McLuhan plot to do. I mean, he's bringing in, he knows, a silly thing. But it actually is accurate in McLuhan's terms. When you engage in a new technology, your secular identity is changed or metamorphosed or killed. So that's an important point. I'm glad we got to it, and I shone again thanks to you finding that. And I'm still alive. I didn't die.
but I may have, so.
Yeah, you probably died several times, but you're just new at this.
Yeah.
Don't worry, you can just reincarnate. So we'll reincarnate in show 6, I guess it would be.
Yeah, so we haven't totally figured out when the next one is, because we've got some scheduling issues. So we will be back at it. There's still lots of stuff to go through. So
yes, and if you're addicted to us, you might have to wait a week and a half or 2 weeks. Who knows?
Yeah, that's why I just wanted to mention that. So yeah, we have to get it together. So.
But what a great find! And isn't that amazing? I bring up the secure quote, and we have it, and it's an important point. It really resonates a lot with the bangs thing and what we're doing.
Yeah, well, I think, I'll definitely read the two pieces in tandem, you know, in the meantime as well, and just, that's very cool, so. And it's in your inbox, so.
Very good.
Okay.
But, you know, I remember, that's what's great, man. I mean, I only dabble in raw criticism, but I knew what to remember.
No, that's amazing that you did.
Yeah. Very
okay,
good.
Bob. Talk to you soon.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, bye-bye.